Hi, I'm Faith Mitchell, President and CEO of Grantmakers in Health. It's my pleasure to present this podcast of David Hemenway's plenary remarks at our 2016 Annual Conference on Health Philanthropy. Dr. Hemenway is a professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He tackles the growing public health crisis of gun violence and calls attention to the critical need for more data and research about firearms. Here's his speech.
So what I'm going to talk about does involve children and families, and it does involve disparities, and it does involve, of course, population health, and it does involve public policy and a little bit about the social determinants of health, but most of all, it involves firearms. I want to, of course, thank foundations who have funded us, particularly the Joyce Foundation, the Bonnet Foundation, Fund for a Safer Future, and others. What I'm going to emphasize today is two things. First, I'm going to talk about the importance of data and research, and then I'm just going to give some examples of what we've been doing so you can get a feeling for the kinds of things we don't know that we really, really should want to know. So a few years ago, I wrote a book about success stories in injury prevention, 64 documented successes of how the world's been made safer, and 36 heroes you've never heard of. And one of the really exciting things for me is that in all the successes, data and research mattered. Data really was important in terms of showing there was a problem and getting people really wanting to do something about it, that you could do something. Data research indicated the kinds of policies that could be effective, and then data and research were crucial to evaluate the policies to see if they worked. And one example would be graduated driver's licenses. The data showed that 16-year-olds were at 3 to 5 times the risk of crashes of 18 to 19-year-olds, 10 times the risk of 35 to 40-year-olds. And then the crucial thing the data showed was also when were kids at highest risk, because kids have to learn how to drive. We don't have enough simulators for everyone, so they're on the road. We want to have them driving, but we want to make them safe. And when they were at highest risk, two periods, one was at night, and one was when they were driving with other kids. And so we created this graduated driver's licensing program in the United States where it says, oh yeah, you're 16, you'll be able to drive, but you can't drive at night, you can't drive with other kids. And we've reduced motor vehicle crashes of these kids by over 30%. Not a perfect success, but an incredibly good one. And then the data were able to show that, yes, this really worked. So I would argue that in the firearms area, we really don't have nearly enough data. I'll talk about the National Violent Death Reporting System. It's not in all the states. We have a whole lot of non-fatal firearm injuries. We really know incredibly little about them. CDC has this wonderful system, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, where they interview about 250,000 people a year about all their health issues. They used to have a gun question. For the last decade, no gun questions. There's a lot of good tracing data from the ATF. Researchers are not allowed to get it. There's incredibly good concealed carry data from the states. The states have made it so researchers can't get it. I'm at a school where there's been incredibly good longitudinal studies over time, look at heart disease and cancer. We have no national study about guns. And even though my goal in life is to put our questions on other people's surveys, I'm often successful, but not for longitudinal surveys because people are so afraid that if they ask a gun question, bad things will happen to them. The key thing is that there's been much too little firearms research. I always say that public health is underfunded relative to medicine, and that within public health, injury prevention is particularly underfunded. And within injury prevention, firearms research is the most underfunded. To give you a feeling, here's data from CDC funding of gun research. At one short period of time, they funded $2.6 million worth of research. That's not a huge amount, but that was their peak. And then through the years, because of a lot of political issues, they basically fund nothing and they are afraid to say the word firearms, our leading public health agency. As NIH stepped up, this just gives you a feeling. Between 1975 and 2012, 30-year period, there were over 4 million people shot in the United States, and NIH gave 3 awards for funding. There were about 2,000 people who caught cholera or diphtheria or polio or rabies in the United States during that period, and NIH gave 486 funding grants. Because there's no money, I'm an economist, people follow the money. We don't have nearly enough research. Here's an example. Someone did a study about PubMed. They looked at, for youth 1 to 17, the 10 leading causes of death for young people. Firearms accounted in the United States for almost 13%. What percent of the articles in public health were about firearms? And the answer is 0.3% compared to these other 10 issues. So basically, just to make it commensurate, we should have 30 times more articles if we wanted to be commensurate to the other areas. I'm always asked, if you had more money, what do we need to know? And the answer is everything. We don't know anything. It's just incredible. One study that shows this and, you name it. That's what we need to know. Let me just give some examples about the type of research that we're doing just so you can get a feeling for the kinds of many, many, many things that can be done. First, just to emphasize that the United States really is just so out of touch with the rest of the advanced countries. The gun lobby likes to compare us to Honduras, to Mexico, to Jamaica, and we're doing well compared to them. But here's a study we just came out looking at the United States versus all the other first world countries, all the other high-income countries. This is just for 5 to 14-year-olds because you're looking at them because they're kids and it's hard to blame the victim. But we could look at women, we could look at the elderly, it doesn't matter. What this shows is that a child in the United States has a higher likelihood of being murdered with a gun than children in France or Italy or Japan or New Zealand or Canada. And it's not 20% higher or twice as high. It's 18 times higher, 18 times higher. Our gun suicide rate for these children is 11 times higher. Our gun accident rate for these children is 12 times higher. I teach at a public health school. We have lots of international students. Nobody can understand why people in the United States allow this to happen to our children, to our women, to whatever. One of the many things that we're doing is trying to understand who really is dying and in what circumstances. It turns out it's not easy to find out. How are suburban women being murdered and by whom? And the answer is try to find it. It's not there. And so we're using the National Violent Death Reporting System, this wonderful system, which is only in a number of states, to look initially at child violent deaths. Child as homicide victims, as perpetrators, and suicides, and so forth. Let me just give you one example of what we're learning. Here's unintentional firearm deaths to children. Because there's so little data out there, you can have supposed scholars, the one or two people who the gun lobby always quotes, saying things like, quote, 2/3 of accidental gun deaths to children are not shots fired by other little kids, but rather by adult males with criminal backgrounds. And he said this over and over. He said this on Fox News. He said this in the LA Times. And we haven't had good data to say that's right or wrong. It doesn't seem right. So now we can look at the National Violent Death Reporting System, and what do we find? We find that when children are killed accidentally, it's by other children. It's not by adults. 1/3 of children who die accidentally, it's a self-inflicted wound. 1/3, it's by other children as shooters. Who are these other children? They're typically a sibling. What sibling? A brother. What brother? An older brother. And typically a best friend. 1/6 are killed by kids who are 15, 16, 17, 18, whom they're playing with. And only 1/6 are killed by adults, and almost all of these are parents, and there's no indication at all that these parents have criminal records. What we can learn, for example, is once we do some studies and have the data, which we finally get, is that, and these are things that I learned that I didn't know, is that yes, most of these kids are killed by other people, but for 2 to 4-year-olds, over 70% of 2 to 4-year-olds who die accidentally are shooting themselves. And how is that happening? What can we do? And it's a very different kind of intervention than for an 11 to 12-year-old. What do we do about kids who are killed in other people's homes? Well, now we have the Ask campaign, which says, ask if your child's going to another house. I have a 6-year-old daughter. Oh, should I ask if she's going to go play at another house? That's what I thought until I found the data. And it turns out that nobody 2 to 4 in our data set was killed, or 5 to 10 was killed at another person's house. But if you have a 13-year-old son who's playing in another house, 45% of the time, if he is killed accidentally, he's going to be killed at that house as opposed to at home or someplace else. And so, yes, then you really should ask. But unless you have the data and the research, you really don't know what you're doing or what you're talking about. One of the things we've been looking at is police. Police are killed in the United States much more than police are killed in other countries. Where are they killed and why? Trying to explain why police are killed more often in some states than others, maybe it's because there's more crime. It turns out that's not what explains it at all. What's the key thing that explains where police are being killed in the United States? And it's in states where there's lots of guns and weak gun laws. That's the answer. And this just, let's look at just the high gun states versus the low gun states. If you're a police officer, you're three times more likely to be killed if you are a police officer in a high gun state. A big issue now is homicide perpetration by police. They're killing a lot of people. We're finally getting to understand that. And we're looking at, why didn't we know this? Is there a good data set? And we looked at the supplemental homicide reports, which have always been used. This is the police reports. We looked at the vital statistics, which is, you know, the gold standard in public health. And then we looked at the National Violent Death Reporting System. And what we found out is that the police reports miss over half of the police killings. And even the vital statistics miss about 40% or more of the police killings. On the other hand, the National Violent Death Reporting System is an excellent data system. We can make that a full data system. We will already have an incredibly good data system about police shootings and killings in the United States. Every gun in the United States starts off as a legal gun. How did this get into the hands of clearly wrong people? And the answer is, well, we're not sure. Sometimes there's straw purchasers, sometimes there's theft, but we don't know very much about it. If you look in the literature, I will argue that there's really not a single peer-reviewed journal article in the entire literature which focuses on gun theft. So we've been starting to look at gun theft. We have a survey we've been looking at. Now we're looking at the National Crime Victimization Surveys. And the first thing that sort of jumps out, which I didn't know, and I'm in this area 30 years, and every time I do a little study, I find, oh, I didn't know that. That's so interesting. It turns out that over half of guns which are stolen, and it looks like it's 300,000 to 500,000 guns a year are stolen in the United States. It looks like that it's much more likely to be stolen if people store their guns inappropriately, which they often do. And that over half the guns stolen in the United States, one way they get into the criminal hands is from the South. They're not stolen from New England. So when the guns are used in Boston and they've been stolen guns, where did they come from? They came up I-95. There's a few articles about the benefits of guns. I'd say single digits. We've written about three or four of them. And here we just have an article looking at self-defense gun use. How often really are there self-defense gun uses? We're looking at the National Crime Victimization Surveys. This is the gold standard for crime in the United States in response. We looked at 5 years. The NCVS has about 60,000 to 80,000 households interviewed twice a year. And just looking at contact crimes where people where you could have done something in self-defense. In this time period, for this data, for these 60,000, 80,000 families, there were 14,000 incidents, an attempted crime. How often did the people use a gun in self-defense? Less than 1% of the time. One of the things which the gun lobby argues is that women really need guns. They'll be able to use these guns in self-defense. In the National Crime Victimization Survey, look at the bottom. In sexual assaults, attempted sexual assaults, how often did women use guns? In the 337 reported sexual assaults, zero. So these guns aren't being used currently. And when they are used, are guns this great panacea? And the National Crime Victimization Survey says, most of the time people did something else. They ran away, they tried to hit somebody, they yelled, they screamed, they called the police, whatever it was. When they did something in a contact crime, 4.2% of the time they were injured. When they used a gun, 4.1% of the time they were injured. Using a gun didn't seem to affect the injury rate whatsoever. After Newtown, I got all these phone calls, and now after every shooting, I get all these phone calls from reporters, and they ask me about various issues, and then I tell them, and I say, here's what the data show, da 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 da. And even though there's not a great literature, there's some literature, and then I read their article, and they say, David Hemenway says something, and John Lott says something else. And I got so annoyed, and I said, come on, this is not he said, she said. There actually is a science with some data and some research. I was talking to one of the reporters, said, you know, this is exactly what used to happen in climate change area. And then there was a study showing that 95% of scientists agree that there is climate change and it's caused by humans. So we didn't have to do he said, she said anymore. So what we've been doing now for the past year and a half is every month we do a survey of gun researchers, the people who have published an article about guns in the peer-reviewed literature, and we ask them questions. So here's one of the questions we asked is a gun in the home a risk factor for suicide? Does it increase the risk? And the answer is that 84% say yes, and basically 8% say no, but sort of 10 to 1. And the answer is yes. It's one of the few things in the literature where there's no question about There are 12 case control studies all showing the same thing. There are 12 ecological studies all showing the same thing. And unfortunately, we've just done a national survey of individuals and nobody understands this. So we're trying to figure out how to get the information out. Over the last 30 years in the United States, one of the interesting, sad things which has happened is that for concealed carry laws, we've gone from a situation where police chiefs had some discretion about who they would give a concealed carry permit to a situation where they have no discretion. In Massachusetts, asking them, how often is it that you have denied a permit to someone who could pass a background check? Because in all most of the other states, you cannot do that. And basically, it's 1% to 2% of the time. And then we ask them, give a reason why you denied this person a permit. And they all had good reasons. They live in these little towns. And they say, this guy has a long history of alcohol abuse. We arrested him for DUI, and he started fighting with the officers. His son came to us and said, please don't give Dad a permit because he's going to commit suicide. And then the one I love was one of the police chiefs asked the guy, why do you want the permit? And he said, because I want to be able to legally take the gun to one of your officers' homes and shoot him in the head. In most states in the United States, police chief has to give this person a concealed carry permit. But this is the first study that ever really looked at that. There aren't any other data out there, and we really need sort of better studies. Every developed country in the world that's a high-income country has requirements for gun training before you get a gun. We don't. Some states do. A lot of people still get gun training. We know nothing at all about what goes on at gun training. No one's ever really looked carefully. So one of the things we're doing is we're sending out people to take actual gun training classes all through New England, and it is frightening what is being caught. There's some trainers who are really good. There's some trainers who are just terrible, 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 who teach exactly the wrong things. So what we're going to try to do is not have a gotcha thing, but try to raise everybody's gun training. And in a minute, I'll talk about how we really are trying to make common ground with a lot of gun advocates, not the NRA at the top who is impossible to deal with, but people at the local level. And one of the things we're pushing for is to try to figure out a way to get gun suicide training, you know, or at least information in these gun training classes. One of the things at the local level, which is so exciting, is that when there's a shooting in Boston, instead of always asking which kid shot which kid, Boston has very strong laws. And what we're asking now, and now what reporters are asking, and what the police are asking is, where did the gun come from? How did these kids get their gun? In every other developed country, kids like this can't get guns. In the United States, they can, even though we have strong laws. Some adult is bringing these guns into the city and making money. And that's maybe what we should be looking at. The second thing is looking at women as straw purchasers. Most people who buy guns are men. When a woman buys a gun, she is much more likely to be buying a gun illegally for somebody who shouldn't have it. And this is one way guns get into the wrong hands. This Operation Lipstick has such incredible play in Boston. All these women are really buying into it. They want to not be part of the problem. They had no idea what they were doing was a felony, and they want to be part of the solution. We're changing social norms so that all women know if your boyfriend's asked you to buy a gun and he shouldn't have one, get rid of that boyfriend. And we're getting the boyfriends to understand that too. A big thing we're working on is suicide prevention. As mentioned, there are many more gun suicides than gun homicides. And what we're trying to do is figure out ways without changing any laws, without changing anybody's mental health, to have a huge impact on suicide in the United States. There's a lot of things we're doing because the evidence is so great, but I just want to mention sort of this finding common ground, which I call sleeping with the enemy. We've been working a lot with gun shops. Turns out not the biggest way, but one thing that sometimes happens is that people go into a gun shop, buy a gun, and kill themselves. And gun shops don't want this to happen. And gun shops can do something about it. And one of the things they can do is that when a woman comes in and says, I want to buy a gun, and they say, what kind? And they say, I don't care. And they say, well, you know, all right, how about this? How many bullets do you need? She says, I don't care. One is enough. Do not sell this woman the gun. And people have been doing this. People have been doing this, and now they're going to stop. And they're going to say, let's get her some help. We're working with gun trainers so that now, for the first time ever, they really are. In Utah, for example, we're going to be talking about suicide. Since for every gun accident, there are probably 30 gun suicides. And that's something these gun trainers can do something about. It's not something about the Second Amendment or anything. One of the great things we did with money from Guns from a Safer Future is do a national gun survey. For the first time in more than a decade, we have good information about how many guns there really are And it turns out there are a lot more guns than there used to be, but there are not a lot more gun owners. It's just that the current owners have more guns. Instead of having 4 guns, now they have 6 or 8 guns. That really doesn't matter very much for suicide. It does matter for getting guns into the wrong hands, because it means when these guns are stolen, more guns are being stolen. And also, for the first time in over 20 years, we were able to say, yes, it's really true what people have been saying without any really good data at all, that about 40% of gun transfers in the United States, there's currently no background check. There's so much we don't know. It's partly because lack of data. It's a lot because of lack of funding. The government has not given any money. This is just incredible. There have been a number of good foundations which have stepped up, but really it's a handful. And this is what foundations should really be doing, is in areas where the government is failing, this is where foundations have to step in. You don't have to step in where the government's already doing an incredibly good job and you're just going to be piling on, which is nice. But this is an area where you can really make a difference. And until now, except for a handful, haven't. But there have been foundation successes. Let me just talk about 2. One was the creation of this incredible data system, the National Violent Death Reporting System. There was, in the 1990s, when CDC was thinking about this and it got cut off at the knees by the federal government, 7 brave foundations stepped up and jump-started the entire system. And we created a good pilot for the system. We showed it could work. We showed it could make a difference. And now CDC has been funding first 16, then 18, now 24, now 31 states. And these foundations, that's what they did. They just did this incredible thing with not a lot of money, but getting together and saying, this is just about research. This is just about getting good data. And they've made an incredible system. And this system now will last forever once it gets fully funded. And that's an incredible success story. Finally, I have to give a shout out to the Wellness Foundation, which unfortunately does almost all its work in California, which I understand is big enough to carry everything. California has the strongest gun laws in the nation now. Why is that? One, it's the California Wellness Foundation. And it shows you what one foundation can do. Yes, a big foundation, but what one foundation can do. And you know, you take a ballpark at these numbers. When they first started, California was very similar to the rest of the country in terms of firearm deaths. And then 18 years later, California has done so much better. Finally, let me say this. There are so many things that can be done. There are so many success stories. This wonderful book only costs about $20 on Amazon.com. Thank you. Questions?
Looks like your stats said that total gun deaths are falling across the country. Is that true, or is that because the data is so bad that we just aren't catching a lot of the...
Yes. Big thing that happened in the last 20, 25 years from the early 90s was that crime in the United States has gone way down. This is also true in the rest of the developed world. I was on an Institute of Medicine committee whose sole task for the last 3 years was to figure out why that's happened. And I think I can say honestly that our major conclusion was is that we have no idea. So gun crime has gone way down, and so gun homicide has gone way down. Gun suicide has gone up a little, but that's the reason. It's that all is crime. And we have explanations that are U.S. specific. And it's like, why did this happen in Canada? Why did this happen in France? Certain types of crime is pretty clear. So like car theft went down incredibly, and that's really because of technology. When I was a kid, it was easy to hotwire a car. Now it's almost impossible. Gun deaths have gone down. Doctors try to say it's because they're better at saving. And that doesn't seem to be, you know, they're not worse, but it's not like they're hugely better. But it's crime has gone so far down, which is great. Nobody understands that, but it's true.
Good morning. Thank you. And all the articles we read about the sane and safe gun owner who hunts, who never leaves his or her guns unlocked, yeah. All of those things. Have you discovered any messages or ways to engage those folks in a way that doesn't lump them in with the kind of folks you might have been talking about today, but allows them to be a force for rational gun safety?
And the answer is no, but that's something we've always wanted to do, but we've had no money. I mean, basically, like our group, now we're down to 4 people, including myself. We have no infrastructure. I do our website, which is just frightening, you know? So yes, that is something that really needs to be known. What we really want to do is try to figure out what's a good typology of gun owners? How can we reach some gun owners in certain ways and other gun owners in other ways? We know nothing.
Hi, good morning. I appreciate your presentation and bringing up this subject. It's been with so many gun shootings in the past few years. I'm a 100% Obama supporter, but I'm wondering what your take is on why there hasn't been more movement in the administration for gun control, for stricter laws, et cetera.
Since Newtown, he's really tried to do a lot of things. He's tried to do as many things possible that he could do on his own. He's tried to make it a priority, and it's just very hard. He puts money in the budget and it gets taken out. So I think given the climate, he's tried to do the best he can. Now, what I would argue is that things got terrible 20 years ago, and now things finally are looking up again. Bloomberg has put some money into advocacy. We have, for the first time ever, national candidates talking about the issue. I can tell just from my local level is that now there are so many more gun stories. So it used to really be, there'd be a shooting and then there'd be stories for about 2 or 3 days and then I'd stop getting calls. But now it's not like there's more shootings. Yesterday, a 4-year-old shot her mom. That used to be local news. Now it's national news. So people have this thing, oh, we have so many more gun deaths. We don't have so many more gun deaths. But finally, these horrible, horrible, horrible things are being reported at the national level. And so reporters are much more interested now than they used to be, which is an incredible thing also. There's maybe not a tipping point, but there's an uptick in interest. And now is the time if something could be done.
I hail from the great state of Florida, where for the second year in a row, the open carry law, which would have made it legal to carry guns openly on university campuses and Disneyland, was defeated at the state level. My question is, has anybody really done the analysis to say where elected officials at both the state and the federal level, how many of them receive NRA money and what percentage of the PAC money that they take? And my follow-up question to that is to say, if you had your dreams come true, would the policies be changed at the federal level or at the state levels? Or what combination would we need to bifurcate to figure out what's a federal issue, what's a state issue?
Let me answer the second question. Certain policies have to be done at the federal level because crime guns move. And so Massachusetts, we have strong laws and we do better than most other states, but 2/3 of our guns used in crime are coming from outside our state. If there were better laws in other places, we'd be much better off. The states with weak laws are terrible neighbors to other states. The United States as a whole is a terrible neighbor. You know, where do Canadian criminals get their guns? The United States. Where do Mexican criminals get their guns? The United States. We had an intern from Jamaica who did a study and found out that over 80% of guns used in Jamaica in crime came from 3 counties in Florida. The second thing is, open carry, I don't think there's ever been a good study about open carry. And where do these people get their money? I haven't seen a good study of that. One of the things you should recognize, though, about the gun lobby is different from, say, the tobacco lobby. The tobacco lobby had a lot of money. The gun lobby has some money, there's no question, but it's not like that size. What the gun lobby has is they have a real grassroots organization in some sense. And I would argue that they have maybe 20,000 people who they can call up or email and get them to do something. And so Congress people, that's who they hear from. If I ever go to hearings, you know, about some gun issue, even in Massachusetts, who will be there is 1 or 2 survivors, maybe a doc, maybe me, and then 20 guys in fatigue screaming and yelling that you're trying to take the guns away from my grandmother who lives in, you know, Milton, and God knows who's going to, you know, I mean. And so if you're a congressperson, that's who you hear from. You don't hear from the silent majority.
Thank you for your presentation. I was wondering, is there any data available about gun storage and gun safety after it's purchased? I'm thinking about kind of policy-level interventions that might be palatable to a wide swath of folks. And if there is data about that, are there any policy conversations around incentivizing gun storage as a way to reduce suicide or as a way to reduce kind of child access?
So there have been a number of studies about gun storage. Typically, what they are is like our recent survey, you call up a lot of people and you ask them, is there a gun in the home and how's the gun stored? And that's basically what we know. One of the things you should recognize that we've discovered and others too, is that if you ask the woman, she's less likely to say there's a gun in the home than the man. And if you ask the woman, she's more likely to say, if she says there is a gun, that it's stored appropriately than the man says. There have been tiny little things about what can we do about how to improve gun storage. There was an interesting study in Alaska where they gave people these great places to store guns and they used them. Massachusetts is, I think, the one state which has a requirement to store your guns appropriately, but it's never been enforced at all, and we have no idea if that really matters or not. But the evidence seems to suggest that storage matters for both suicide and gun accidents. Again, people haven't really looked at gun theft, though you'd think it would matter. People have a million ideas about how to incentivize, but we have no data or information about what will work and what won't work.
Yes, hi. I'm Kathy Harding from the great gun state of Kansas, getting greater guns every day because of policymakers. We have a mayor in Kansas City, Kansas, who is nothing if not outspoken, who recently said just in the past couple of weeks at a public meeting that 20 years from now, we'll be looking at the NRA the same way that we look today at Big Tobacco, that the NRA really is all about profit. They're doing everything that they can to ensure that guns continue to be sold in whatever way they can. I just would like to hear your comments on that or your thoughts.
I have no idea what's going to happen 20 years from now. What I can say is that the NRA probably has 3 million members, something like that. A lot of them don't believe in what the NRA stands for when you're on surveys, when you ask. The United States seems to be a different country than most others because we have given so much power to single-issue lobbies like the NRA, and single-issue lobbies tend to be much more radical than the members. If you look carefully at what the NRA promotes and doesn't promote, it seems to align exactly with what is good for gun sales. It sort of makes sense. They get a fair amount of their money from the manufacturers. The manufacturers are in a tough business because guns last so long. So they got to figure out a way to keep business up, and the best way is fear. Anytime there's a shooting or anytime that, you know, Obama says hello, they say, that was a code word to take your guns away, and so you better buy them now. And so that's what they do. But you should recognize, too, the NRA is not a democratic institution, and that the NRA was not always like this, and it really changed in the 70s when the radicals took over in a real coup, a real palace coup. And maybe you could have a different palace coup. I sort of doubt it, but I'm not the expert on that.
Hi, you've mentioned the limitations of surveys in shedding light, but I'd just like to underscore that one of the ways that foundations, who may be shy of policy advocacy per se, can be very helpful is increasing the information available. Our foundation is Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, and with Interact for Health up in Ohio, we do an annual Kentucky Health Issues poll, and we asked folks, do you have a gun in the home? Is it locked or unlocked? Is it loaded or unloaded? And a little later in the survey, we asked if they had children in the home. And then we publicized the percentage of parents of children with loaded, unlocked guns as an impetus for more training.
One of the studies we did once was, first we tried it in Massachusetts, and we got people who were going into the pediatrician's office, the parent and the child, and we separated them, and then we asked them a lot of questions about guns and see if they gave the same answer. Didn't work at all in Massachusetts. We had 350 pairs, and there was only like 12 people had guns. And then we found pediatricians in Alabama. We did the same thing, and of the 350 dyads, we had 200 people who had guns. And then we asked sort of questions. And what you find is that the parents have no idea about the children. The average age of the kid is 10. Has your kid ever handled a gun? Some say sure, but the ones who say no, they've never handled a gun. They don't even know where it is. And then we ask the kids, and if it's particularly a boy, they say, you know, they think we don't know where the Christmas presents are. Are you kidding? You know, we know where everything is. Of course we played with the gun. What do you think? And parents have no idea about that.
And we can shed light on those kinds of things by funding studies like the study that you
mentioned. It'd be great. There are lots of researchers out there who have great ideas who would be willing to do lots of studies, but they can't. I tell doctoral students who are really interested not to do guns, because I'm in a soft money school and public health is mostly soft money. You cannot make a living doing gun research. You can maybe write one of your papers about guns, but your job paper has to be about something else. It has to be about obesity or HIV or something, because otherwise you won't be able to support yourself. There just isn't enough money to do all the stuff I would like to do in the gun area.
Hi, I'm Lou Papa from Rochester, New York. And in New York, even in a blue state, you can see a big divide where in the South, there's a very anti-gun feeling. I'm up in Rochester. I was originally from downstate. And every other lawn has a placard that says, repeal the SAFE Act. So these people love their guns. Has anybody ever thought about an alternative gun advocacy group? That if there is a number of individuals in the NRA that don't like their policies, maybe have another gun advocacy group that promotes safety and undercuts their membership and actually speaks for the gun owner rather than the gun seller.
There's been at least three groups that have tried to do that, not very successfully. Most successful group is probably Gabby Giffords' group, which has been trying to do that. Paul English tried to create that. He was the head of Kayak, sold it out, and he's in the Boston area. He tried to do that very unsuccessfully. The big problem is In the same way, groups who are for reasonable gun laws haven't been successful. What brings these people together? It's hard to figure out. I mean, they all love guns, and we're going to have lots of guns in the United States, and they love to play with their guns, and that's what brings them together, and so they can do that, and then, you know, on the side, they can shoot at Hillary Clinton pictures. They have something to do, whereas a lot of the other groups, it's hard to figure out. But yes, it would be nice if that could happen, but it's not like no one's had that idea before.
Rhonda Smythe from Missouri. There's a proposal currently in the works for a private business to come and open like a gun vault slash check-in facility outside of our stadium where our baseball team plays. Can you speak a little bit about normalizing open guns?
I can talk about it, but there's no research about it. What the gun lobby would love to do is normalize guns every place. What we do know from all the studies is that more guns, more death. Because guns make hostile interactions or depression much more likely to end in death than without. That's what we know. And so typically, making guns more normalized makes things worse. That's what I can tell you. The argument that's always made is, oh, you know, what we really need to do is we only train our kids from the very beginning. You know, just think of alcohol. You know, in France, they normalize drinking really young and things are good. And then it turns out when you look at the data, no, things are terrible. Things are much worse where they normalize drinking early. The same way, it probably is true, though, again, the studies are not there. There's no studies that normalizing guns early is probably not a great idea. But guns are used for different things. And people who are born, raised as hunters and live in the country and just have shotguns, that's not the huge problem, though it is a suicide problem. And it probably is a domestic violence problem, but it's not going to lead to a lot of gang killings. And
the police department argument is that because guns aren't allowed to be brung into these public spaces, yeah, that thieves are capitalizing upon the opportunity where tens of thousands of cars are coming into the city with guns. Can you give me a good response that we could make to that?
On a different level, one of the things that we're trying to do is to change social norms about guns and suicide so that just as friends don't let friends drive drunk, we're trying to make it the social norm that if your friend is going through a bad period, he's, you know, just got divorced and he's drinking and he's talking crazy, that he should recognize he ought to get rid of his gun for a while, and you as a good friend should recognize that you should take his gun for a while. And I would argue that's what should have happened in Newtown. Not a law, but basically everyone should have known that Nancy Lanza's kid was in a big bad state and Nancy should have gotten rid of her guns, and all her friends should have said, you know, little Adam is in a bad period. Maybe in 2 years he'll have a girlfriend and things will be fine, but right now let us store their guns. The problem is it's unclear where you can store guns legally. And is it legal just to take somebody else's gun for a while? And then do you have responsibility for it? And police often don't want it, and gun shops don't always want it, and gun ranges don't always want it. And so it really would be nice if there were places that were safe that people could store their guns and maybe get them out of the house even, which would be much better. But I don't know about the Missouri question exactly.
Hi, I'm Tracy Fowler with New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. So New Hampshire, for those of you who don't know, we are a live free or die state.
Live free and die.
That's exactly right. What you were talking about in terms of reducing access to lethal means. So I wasn't sure if you're familiar with CALM. It's called Counseling on Access to Lethal Means. It's CALM as an acronym. So pills, guns, obviously. Yeah. But in terms of who can store them, I think at the community level, that's where that community change kind of organizing comes in, because then you can start talking to gun shops and police departments. And so you sort of develop that network of safety measures of who will take it so people know. We've seen department to department, some police departments will take it. Obviously, some people don't want to give their gun to a police department. Yep. Some police departments do gun locks.
New Hampshire did great because it's so small that at the public health department level, they could really see, investigated when deaths happened. And they noticed that there were three suicides in 1 week where the person had used the gun that they had just bought at one of the gun shops. And this is really what started this movement. And now there's probably close to 24 places which are trying to figure out ways to use gun shops and to think about the CALM movement. And the CALM is really excellent. We do a lot of work now with the VA. And there's no question that probably the most effective way of reducing suicide, it's so hard to change mental health, but it's pretty much easier to get rid of lethal means. I would argue that in the 20th century, the great public health success stories in terms of suicide had to do with getting rid of lethal means. It had not had to do with changing mental health. So, for example, in England, about half the people used to commit suicide was to put their heads in the oven. very good way because it was painless and it wasn't disfiguring and then you're just dead. Then the gas was changed. So instead of having a lot of carbon monoxide, didn't have any. And so you could put your head in the oven and then after a while you just take your head out because nothing was happening. People then don't go on to kill themselves, and the deaths from stoves went to zero and other deaths didn't change at all. Another example of lethal means changes is in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka for a while was the leading country for suicide in the world. And they're horrible, horrible. The way they kill themselves mostly is they drink these incredibly lethal pesticides. And it's a slow and horrible death, takes about 3 days. And so you can talk to these people and most of them say, you know, if they had to do it again, no, it's a mistake, but you can't do anything for them. But what the Sri Lankan government did is it started banning the most lethal pesticides, which have always been banned in all developed countries. And people still drink the pesticides, but now they don't die nearly as often. And so their suicide rate has gone way down. And this is one of the things where we think there's really common ground with gun advocates.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm 1440 Foundation here in California. I had heard a report recently that there hadn't been enough work with the gun manufacturers to make the guns more safe themselves.
Yeah.
And if you think about how technology, you know, thumbprint technology, right, all these, yep, things could be employed. Can you, yeah, speak to that?
Sure. I used to work for Ralph Nader in the 60s, and we did all this stuff about cars, trying to figure out ways cars safer, and car manufacturers fought and fought and fought against everything. The reason we have seatbelts is because they were mandated. It took over 20 years to get airbags in cars. The manufacturers said, we can't do this. It's impossible. You can't make them work. The dealer said you couldn't do it. And then finally it was mandated and we get all these. In the firearms area, manufacturers spend a lot of time and energy figuring out how to make guns more concealable and how more lethal, but not more safe. But outside people have tried to make these smart guns so that nobody else could use your gun. Years ago, my car radio got stolen, and then the next car I bought had a little sign that said, you can take the car radio, but once it leaves the car, it won't work. And thefts of car radios went way down. What you want is the same thing. You can steal this person's gun, but it's not going to do you any good. It's not going to work. You can be a teenager and try to use the gun to kill yourself, but it's not going to work. Armatex, I think, is the one that's probably the best one out there. Three different gun shops have tried to sell it. They've been inundated with death threats and boycotts from the gun lobby. And they've all stopped selling in the United States. Why? The supposed reason was in New Jersey, they had a law which said once smart guns are being sold, and after 3 years, only smart guns could be sold. But the attorney general says that Armatex is not a smart gun, and the people tried to rescind that law, but not the gun lobby. The gun lobby actually likes that law. Everything is just a way to take away their guns. And you'd think, gee, this would be a great thing because there'd be a whole new market for guns, but that's not the way they see it. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.